Along the tired to my dinai.
Along the tired to my dinai.
Tilanam Shiva Mastuba.
Tilanam Shiva Mastuba.
Vakshi Heshavara Kanya.
Vakshi Heshavara Kanya.
Patnitve Pratigriyatam.
Patnitve Pratigriyatam.
Alam Dhadaya Jumajinai. Dhyanam Shiva Mastuva.
Dhyanam Shiva Mastuva.
Vakshi Heshavara Kanya.
Vakshi Heshavara Kanya.
Patnitve Pratigriyatam. There's no need to burn these trees any longer. Let whatever trees still remain be happy. Indeed, you should also be happy. Now, here is a beautiful, well-qualified girl named Marisha, who was raised by the trees as their daughter. You may accept this beautiful girl as your wife. Next verse. Shukadeva Goswami continued. My dear king, after thus pacifying the Prachetas, Soma, the king of the moon, gave them the beautiful girl born of Pramlocha Apsara. The Prachetas all received Pramlocha's daughter, who had high, very beautiful hips, and married her according to the religious system. In the womb of that girl, the Prachetas all begot a son named Daksha, who filled the three worlds with living entities. Purport. Daksha was first born during the reign of Swayambhuva Manu, but because of offending Lord Shiva, he was punished by having the head of a goat substituted for his own head. Thus insulted, he had to give up that body. And in the sixth manvantara, called the Chakshusha manvantara, he was born of the womb of Marisha as Daksha. In this connection, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes this verse. His previous body had been destroyed, but he, the same Daksha, inspired by the Supreme Will, created all the desire of the Vyanis in the Chakshusha manvantara. Thus, Daksha regained his previous opulence and again begot thousands and millions of children to fill the three worlds. Om Gyana Chimarandasya Gyanam Jana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. So what is this chapter about? How did Shukadeva Goswami, or particularly Prichit Maharaj, start off the chapter? This chapter is about an inquiry into the secondary creation. First, it's already been settled that the original substance comes from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Any thinking person has it on their mind. What is the origin of everything? You must think what is the origin of everything in order to find out the ultimate proprietor. But people don't feel that burden today, and therefore they're not considered human beings. Ask anybody, and you know, they feel quite all right without understanding who the supreme proprietor is. But this is rejected in the Vedic literature. This is not human life. You must immediately take note of yourself and what is around you. Take note that there is matter and spirit, and then you must find the ultimate source of both. The greatest brains in human society today will not do that. They refuse to do that. They cannot give you any information as to what is the source of everything. And in fact, in order to defend themselves, they'll tell you that such a question, what is the ultimate source, is not really scientific. In other words, because we can't answer it, and because our senses can't find out the answer, therefore it's not scientific. Because we cannot perceive the ultimate substance, we can't figure it out. All we can say is that there was something before time and space, and that something exploded in the Big Bang, and then the universe came into being. That's all they can explain. What is that original substance? They cannot say. They just say it's a mysterious point, which has no relation to time and space, because time and space were created afterwards in the Big Bang. So from this mystery came the Big Bang, and all time and space were created, and then the universe expanded. And even today you can still hear the echo of that Big Bang. So, you ask them, where did the original thing come from? Well, don't ask that. This is not really science. What is the Vedic perspective? If you cannot answer what is the ultimate cause, the origin, then you don't have science. So, it takes a great devotee of Lord Krishna, like Srila Prabhupada, to establish what is actually science. We never thought otherwise. We think it's quite all right when someone says, well, it's all right if you don't know what the origin is. Such a question is probably outside of science. Oh, yes. We would think like that. And it's easy to think like that when you're engaged in sinful activity. Just let the intoxication come, let the illicit sex come, the gambling, the meat eating. That's the main thing. As for wondering what the ultimate origin is, sometimes you may think like that, sometimes not. Just like in Japan, for example, the people pride themselves on not being religious. They feel very proud that they are first-class materialists. And indeed, there's no doubt, the Japanese, they're unrivaled in their materialistic samadhi. They're just fixed without deviation. So, their idea is that sometimes in life there are some problems, there's some heavy situations, and in those few moments you can contemplate in a religious way who is controlling, what's it all about, what's the source. But as soon as you get over the problem, then you get your strength back and you go right back to your normal way of living. So they think, at most, religion is just good for the few weak moments in your life. And they pride themselves that there's no religion actually in Japan. They say that religion has caused so many problems, therefore we're better off without it. And just see how united our country is without religion. There's no strife in our country because there's no religion. This is the thinking of demoniac persons. Without understanding, the ultimate issues will be all right. And this is the kind of training that is given to people today in society everywhere. You can look at this whole city of Perth. You'll see people walking around not having the slightest bit of anxiety that they don't understand who they are and why they're here. Do you ever look at the city in that way? Do you ever do that? A million or so people scurrying here and there. And they have not one bit of anxiety that, I don't know why I'm here, I don't know who I am, I don't know what the nature of this universe is, I don't know what the ultimate cause is. Whether you go to the university, as Chandrasekhar can tell you, or you go to the streets and meet the people, as Dr. Edward may tell you, you find the same thing. No one knows and they think, I'm all right, even though I don't know this. But this is not human civilization according to the Vedic standard. The Vedic standard is, if you have the human body, you must be making progress to answer these questions. But the fact is, unless you alter your lifestyle, you're never going to address these questions in an effective way. To actually get to the bottom of this requires at least the mode of goodness. Only the person in the mode of goodness, whose senses are controlled, and begin to see things as they are. Otherwise, you have masses of people, even professors and scientists, who are in the mode of passion and ignorance, and they think that they have intelligence. And we reject that. And people can understand that sometimes. Oh, you're just a weird group. You're just a fringe of society. But let's analyze the quality of society and see who wants to really be an active part of such a society. That's something everyone has to ask. Do I consider myself a part of this society? And if so, what is my future? An intelligent person wants to escape from this kind of ignorance. And the next thing is, once you escape, you help others. Just like in the material sense, if someone escapes from a burning house and then goes back in to bring the others out, everyone says, how glorious. Similarly, in Krishna consciousness, once you've pulled yourself out of the fire, if you can get others out, then Krishna gives you his special attention. So first we have to understand that we are living in a very horrible time. Sometimes devotees are asking me, as soon as I came here at the airport, devotees are asking me, what do you think about the coming disasters? So, coming disasters? It's already here. The disaster's already here. It's known as Western civilization. The Holocaust is already here. People have no chance to be Krishna conscious. Their spiritual potential is being destroyed, being slayed. They have no chance. Even when they're little kids, they're watching television and seeing so many lusty scenes on TV. They're witnessing their parents. They have no hope. They're saturated in passion and ignorance from the very beginning of their life. During the Guru Puja, Prabhav and I, we were watching the two of the little kids, one boy and one girl. The little boy and little girl, they just went up to each other and embraced. So I said to Prabhav, don't you wish you could do that? Just without being affected at all? But as soon as you pass a certain age and the hormones start to boil, you can't do that. You've been victimized by material nature. You just saw it, how many saw the little boy and little girl embrace? It just spontaneously, without a thought of any kind of lust, without a thought of anything sexual. Now you can see that's freedom. But what happens when the age of 12 comes? There's no such thing as innocent childhood. It's only a matter of time for your karma to catch up with you. The karma is just waiting for the right development of the body, and then it strikes. So therefore, the Vedic system is how to organize society to deal with when the lusty desires strike. But people, they have no understanding of this. They get so fascinated with the innocence of childhood. Look at the little babies. Look at the little children. And then, all of a sudden, the children turn 11 or 12 and become monsters. No one even gets freaked out about that anymore. They just think, well, it's part of life. The parents were degraded and are degraded, so they're not surprised when the children become degraded. They just ask of their children, don't get too much into trouble. One survey was taken in England by this most powerful advertising firm in the world, Saatchi & Saatchi. So they were researching what's the teenage girl market like these days. Where are the teenage girls at when they're 12 years old? And they found that almost always, any family that had a little bit of money, they would give their 12-year-old daughter a cell phone and say, you can stay out as late as you want, do whatever you want, but you've got your cell phone. If there's any real problem, just give us a call. That's their answer to the problems of existence. Just make sure you have your cell phone. And then they say, if it really gets tough, just take a taxi home, we'll pay for it. Otherwise, you're on your own. You got your cell phones. That's child raising today. Have cell phone, do whatever you like. And if it really gets bad, in case of emergency, take a taxi. That's the best information they can give their children. Otherwise, yeah, make sure you're taking your pills. And they also say, don't get too drunk when you drink. And you've got your cell phone. You've got your birth control pills. The taxi is there in case there's a real problem. Go for it. That's all I can say. That's all the parents can tell. That's the only thing they can tell their children. So this is what this advertising firm found out in their research. That the parents felt secure. My 12-year-old daughter has a cell phone. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. She's not home yet, but she's got her cell phone. I'm not worrying. Now, how do you expect any kind of decent human beings to come out of such a culture? It's not possible. Society has to be arranged so that from the very beginning of life, we are contemplating these ultimate questions and trying for a solution. So these children here at the Guru Puja, they don't know the effect that's happening to them, but it's there. They are participating in pure Krishna conscious activities. They'll keep that with them, the effects, throughout their life. Maybe they all don't become Paramahansas overnight. Maybe they have to go through some teenage turbulence. But certainly, they're getting eternal credits. All the parents can do in Krishna consciousness is do your best. That's all that Krishna asks you to do. Bring your children to the temple. Let the children see you chanting. Teach the children about Krishna. One thing you have to bear in mind is that children are very expert observers. They'll shock you how much they pick up. You think they're just spacing out, but they're watching and they mimic what they see. So if the parents are serious devotees, the children will pick up on that. That is a fact. And if you're doing things improperly, they'll pick up on that too. For example, Prabhupada himself said that sometimes when there's problems with little kids pretending to have sex life at a young age, they don't know what they're doing, but they're just pretending to do something. He said that's because they've seen the parents. And the parents are thinking, oh, the children are asleep. We can, you know, engage. And no, the children are watching. And therefore, when they're 5 or 6 or 7, they start trying to imitate what they've seen without understanding. So we have to take that into account. How observant children are. And the parents have to be tolerant in that they don't get upset when their children don't turn into Prahlad Maharajas overnight. They have to be willing to go the distance with them, to see the ups and downs. That's what's required to be a parent. Great determination. Not that you just get discouraged, oh, We had a child in Krishna consciousness. We did everything right. We followed the regular principles. And our child was so saintly for the first 10 years, 12 years. And now he or she's a teenager and not chanting anymore and wants to experience a bit of the world. That phase may come. And the parents have to have the determination that we're going to see this thing through to the end. This is necessary. Even old-fashioned Christian families, they have this determination. I know, for example, my mother, she raised us in a very strict Christian way. Did I ever tell you about this? So, she was always confident that her sons, they may go through their teenage rebellious period, but she knew ultimately, I'm going to win. Ultimately, they're going to be servants of the Lord. So, of course, I won't tell you about myself, but I'll tell you about my brother. He was 19 years old and going to university. He was going to university from home because after I left to go to school far away, my mother vowed, none of my kids is ever going away to school again. I can't watch him. I can't see what he's doing. Never again. So she had him stay at home and go to the university in the city. commuting. So he was 19, and he was, you know, fully into the university culture. You know, forget this Christianity, it's the oppressor's religion. So he got into radical politics, declared himself an atheist. Really proud of my mother, an atheist in her family. So she had a principle that you couldn't eat dinner unless you said a Bible verse. So I was away from home most of the time, but sometimes I'd come back from school to visit, and you know, I would just laugh at it, and I would just pick out a Bible verse which had no devotional content, and I would say it. And Mother would really get mad. What could she do? I picked out a Bible verse. I think my favorite was from the Old Testament. And the water ran off the altar into the trough. So she would just glare at me like, come on, Mom, it's a Bible verse. The only one she forbade was Jesus wept. This is a two-word verse. You could say any verse but that. You could say Jesus wept. So my brother, he took it as a real challenge. You know, I'm not surrendering to Mom's, oppressive religion. No, I'm a revolutionary for the people. So he would, every dinner time, there was a square off. You know, it was like a match. He would be upstairs in his bedroom, and she's dinner. And so he would start coming down the stairs singing radical politics songs. All power to the people. Brown power to the brown people, white power to the white people, yellow power to the yellow people, all power to the people. And so my mother, she'd be ready, waiting at the dinner table. You know, he'd come in there. Remember, if you sit down at the dinner table, you're going to have to say your Bible verse. No, I'm not saying any verses from that oppressor's religion. So that, you know, he would sit down at the table and she wouldn't feed him, and he would just sit there, trying all sorts of techniques, trying to look real sorrowful. Mom, you're not going to feed me. And she would just have no mercy. Unless you say a Bible verse, you're not even. So that's the way she was. So then once, he was 19 and he didn't come home. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, mothers, they have this alarm system. She woke up in the middle of the night. My son's not back. It's 3 a.m. So then she said, I know where he is. He's with his girlfriend. I'm going to find him. He's 19, you know. So she gets up, you know, and she jumps in the car. You know, she takes her father with her. You know, he's like, come on, dear. I'm into it too much. He's a man. Just 5 a.m. in the morning. I'm trying to sleep. No, no. He's sinning. We're going to bring him back. She's so determined. So at 5 a.m., you know, first she rummages through his room, finds out the address of his girlfriend. She and father jump in the car. They drive to the house. Ring the bell, you know, ring and ring. Finally, you know, this girl comes down the stairs wearing a bathrobe, you know, 5 a.m., wondering what's going on. Open the door. My mother says, where's my son? Bring him here now. Yes. Brother comes down, comes to the door, you know, wiping the sleep from his eyes, you know. Mother! What are you doing here? Get in the car! Then she turns to the girl and says, you're wasting your life. You better get saved. I want to see you for lunch tomorrow. So father is just shaking his head like, wow, this lady is really determined. He wasn't so much into it, you know, but mother was really, you know, got to save him from the devil. So, you know, she put him into the car, told the girl, I'll see you tomorrow for lunch, right? And the girl actually came for lunch all trembling. The mother said, look, you're wasting your life. You may want to waste your life, but I don't want you wasting my son's life. You better get right with the Lord. Girl left town the next week. So that's the kind of determination it takes to raise Krishna-conscious children. It's not a casual matter. Well, we managed to chant our japa before we had the kid, and now the Lord will take care. No, you've got to be into it year after year. And it's a purifying process. By that, one becomes purified. You see that, as Prabhupada said, whether licit or illicit sex, it takes a lot of energy out of you to be responsible for the offspring. Of course, with licit sex, there's no karmic reaction. With illicit sex, there is always karmic reaction. Because you're involving yourself with material happiness. Material happiness means reaction. And of course, that so-called happiness only is distress. It's just a matter of time. So, the Vedic system is, all right, you're feeling some desire for the opposite sex, then take responsibility for that desire and see what you have to go through. And the point is that by the end of your life, well, ideally by the time you're 50, you'll see what the thing is all about. And you'll think, I don't really want to go through this. I see how many complexities are born of this desire. So that's the whole Vedic system, that you become realized in the results of sex desire. But if the regular principles are not followed, you don't get that realization. The whole Vedic system is geared to make you see the effects of your desire. But if you try to cheat, then you never learn that lesson. So by the time you're 50, you're still wallowing in these desires. You haven't made a solution. So part of the solution is that you have children in Krishna consciousness, and you raise them in Krishna consciousness through thick and thin. You have that patience and determination. I can tell you one example of it. Just one. It won't be too embarrassing. So, I came back from university. I was 18. I started when I was 17. So, my mother, she was ready for action. She had something on her mind. So, she said, "Son, when's the last time you had a medical checkup?" "Medical checkup, Mom? Come on! I'm in perfect health. I'm fine." No, son. I'm a hospital administrator. I think you need a medical checkup." "Mom, look, you know, I don't know where you got this idea from. Everything is all right." No. She was determined. "You got to go to a medical checkup." So I went to the medical checkup. The doctor went through all his thing, you know, making tests, X-rays, this or that. He told my mother, "Your son's in perfect health." She looked at him. And then she threw her cards down on the table. "Doctor, what I really want to know is, does he smoke marijuana?" The doctor, he looked at her like she was crazy. And he took her into his office without me hearing. And she told me later, he said, "You know what? You know, your son's fine. He's going to, you know, most famous university. He looks all right. You know what? Be happy, you know? He's got a great career. Why are you worried? You know, don't bother like this." So that was the doctor's advice. Anyway, she changed doctors immediately. So that's the kind of determination it takes to be a Krishna-conscious parent. So her idea was, my sons may go through this and that, but sooner or later they're going to come out for the Lord. So my brother, he was the atheist. So she got rid of his first girlfriend, the one she caught, you know, she caught him at her house. Then the second one, my brother eventually married. So they were both atheists. So then my mother devised a plan. She started working on the wife. Win her for Christ. So then she got the wife converted, and then they both went after my brother. Now he's washed in the blood. It's only me she has a problem with. "I understand your pure lifestyle, but why can't it be for Jesus?" She can't figure that one out. I'm sure I told you some years ago how she told me confidentially one day, "You know, while you were being conceived, I was praying to the Lord, please send me a servant of the Lord." I said, well, Mom, what are you complaining about then? You know, I'm chanting Hare Krishna. You prayed while you were conceiving me that you wanted to serve in the Lord, so what's the problem? She said, but I meant for Jesus, not for Krishna. I said, well, Mom, you should have been more specific in your prayer. So, the point is that if mundane religious persons can have this kind of determination with their family life, we also certainly need at least that much determination. Because the times are so much degraded now. Without very committed parents, it's not possible to raise children in Krishna consciousness. The children have to be procreated in a Krishna conscious way, nurtured in a Krishna conscious way. They have to see parents who are going to stay together all the life. Divorce is so horrible for children, especially in Krishna consciousness. It rips apart the Vedic system completely. So our parents have to have some understanding of the Vedic system, of Vedic culture, that they're taking up a responsibility in order to purify themselves. They're undergoing a duty. They're not undergoing a chance for sense gratification. This is very important. You're taking on the yoke of Vedic responsibility towards one another. It's like two persons going into business together. You're both partners in an enterprise for going back to Godhead. Temporary lusty desires. Now it is a fact that the Shastra says household life is an opportunity for sense gratification. That means while pursuing the Vedic injunctions, there is opportunity to explore these temporary desires. But it's all arranged in such a way that you do learn your lesson. That is the wonder of the Vedic system. Whereas barbarian culture plunges you into lusty desires and you never learn from it. Marriage, divorce, if you marry at all. So many young people you meet these days, what do they tell you? We've been living together for 3 years and we have a 2-year-old child and we're thinking about getting engaged. So many like that. I don't know in Perth, but Sydney is like that everywhere. It's considered normal. And we're thinking about getting engaged now that our child is 2 years old. They don't understand the need for regulating the senses. Therefore, we need very effective husbands and wives. It's going to be very difficult amidst culture today, but it has to be done. This whole chapter is about protection. Soma is asking the Pratetas, you should consider the trees as worthy of your care. He points out that just like the eye gives, just like the eyelid protects the eye, and the husband protects the wife, and the parents protect the children, the teacher protects the student by giving knowledge. Similarly, we should be concerned with protecting all living entities. So that is the Vedic system, how everyone gets protection. As soon as you stop seeing the protection part of it, it all doesn't make sense. What's this about a woman protected by a man? Then the children will think, why should the children be protected by the parents? The students will think, why should we learn from a teacher? On and on it goes. As soon as you lose sight of the principle of protection, nothing in Vedic culture makes sense. But the foolish living entities today, they think they don't need protection. Because they're swollen with lust and pride. They think, I'm all right. I know what I'm doing. Just give me the sense gratification. Whereas the Vedic system is, let's reduce the sense gratification and let's give you protection. Now, how many of you, when you were in the material world, thought, I need protection? No, your first concern was, I need sense gratification. And this is not human life. Human life means, whether you're male, female, child, old, you need protection. And it's the job of the government to give that kind of protection. The women need to be protected. The children need to be protected. The old people need to be protected. Even Young adults who are neither babies nor old persons need protection. What's the protection they need? They need knowledge. And then, of course, nature needs to be protected. The trees, the cows. This is all political science, according to the Vedas. How everyone is protected so they can make progress. Because if you do violence towards other species of life, you check their progress in evolving to the next level. And that means it takes them longer to get to the human form of life. They've got to go back and repeat. So that's considered a great crime. I was with Srila Prabhupada once on a morning walk in Los Angeles, and he explained that if the human being loses his human form of life and goes back to the animal species, it's not that you just become a dog once and that's it for the dog species. No, you've got to become every type of dog. You become a tree, you've got to become every type of tree, and then you move up. I heard him directly say this. It's very, very, makes you very serious. Because there's no protection for people today, as Prabhupada always said, they're risking their next life. They're gambling. They're heading right for an animal birth. They don't care. I want sense gratification. I don't need protection. But Vedic culture means how everyone is protected, not simply the human beings, the trees, the animals. This requires knowledge. And knowledge is the best protection. When there is spiritual knowledge, the husband knows what to do, the wife knows what to do, the children know what to do, the old men, the old women know what to do. Everyone knows how to treat the trees, the cows. It all works when you focus on this central point of protection. So similarly, here at our temple, we have to have a culture of protection. There should be protection for each member of our temple. Protection doesn't mean let's make it so you can have sense gratification easier. Protection means let's protect your chances of going back to Godhead. So we need qualified persons to help in that protection department. That is Vedic culture. And this is why people cannot understand Vedic culture. They're just looking, where is the opportunity for uncontrolled sense gratification? We don't see it anywhere. Therefore, how can you live like this? They're not thinking protection. Anyone who is civilized, they'll look at the Krishna conscious lifestyle and see everyone's being protected. How nice. But we don't have human culture today. Therefore, people don't appreciate it. So it is up to the devotees to display this. In our families, they have to be models of protection. Not models of, well, we got married 2 years ago, but we're having difficulty and maybe it just wasn't right. You know what? I know what it was. We forgot to check an astrologer before we were married. So now, 2 years later, we're having problems. So therefore, you can understand why we're divorcing. That all makes sense. So we didn't check the astrologer first. Therefore, we have it out. It is a very great responsibility to be a grihastha. It means that the husband and wife are agreeing to stay with one another after the romance wears off. That is hard. After the shine wears off, you know, you polish something up. Those people who wear leather shoes, they're polishing them. They look quite different when it's polished on. When it's polished on our cars, you take your car to it, get it waxed. But when the polish wears off, it looks old and shabby. So similarly, in family life, when the polish of romance wears off, then things become a bit difficult. Then you really come face to face with what are we doing together? And you have to decide, are we together for the purpose of protection and going back to Godhead, or were we together just for a joyride? This takes deep deliberation. And there has to be a supportive culture that helps you. You two married because you wanted to help one another go back to Godhead. Remember? Oh, yeah, right. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I forgot about that one. I just got so much absorbed in her driving me crazy. And, oh, I got so absorbed in how he's not doing this and that. And And you remember, we're supposed to be going back to Godhead. Now, how can we arrange for that? And of course, there's always children involved. And so you begin to consider, we brought these children into the world. It's our responsibility to help them go back to Godhead. Then everything starts to make sense. Otherwise, the sure formula for failure is simply to concentrate on one another's attractive qualities. No. The attractive thing is not the temporary physical or mental beauty. The attractive thing is the duty, the commitment. And the commitment is based on giving protection. So the husband has to be qualified to protect. The wife has to be qualified to protect. Everything is working together, all for the purpose of going back to Godhead. So Soma is telling the trees this. The whole problem began when Narada Muni preached to the Prachetas' father, King Prachinabarhi, and the king went to the forest to perform austerities, and there was no one to take over the kingdom because his 10 sons were underwater performing austerities. So they came out of the water and they saw that because it was improper government or no government, trees had grown everywhere and therefore it was not possible to produce food. So they got very angry. What is this imbalance of nature? How dare the trees do this? It's not possible to farm the land like this. So they, because they had power from austerity, they produced wind and fire and were burning all the trees out. And that's when Soma, the demigod in charge of the moon, interfered with this. This is not mythology that there is a demigod in charge of the moon. It means that consciousness is so powerful that it's able to supervise planets and the functions of nature. Not matter. Why do you think matter is so powerful? When you hear that there's Soma, the moon demigod, you think, oh, this is some kind of mythology. I don't know if I can swallow this. Or this is some kind of Vedic metaphor or allegory. When you say that, what exactly are you doing? You're investing all your faith in matter. You're saying, no conscious entity could ever be in charge of the moon, but matter is in charge. That's what you're actually saying. I have faith in matter. Matter runs the whole universe. This Vedic stuff about demigods is pure mythology. Matter can do it all. You speak like a scientist. It's the laws of nature. But where did the laws of nature come from? That they cannot tell you. But when they hear about demigods, Soma, they laugh. This is primitive Hindu mythology. Meanwhile, with their so-called science, they're doing everything to try to be the controller. But when they hear about someone else controlling, oh, this is mythology. My control? Oh, that's very important. So you're getting a glimpse into the Vedic universe. Soma, he's in charge of vegetation. In Bhagavad Gita, what does Krishna say? Samabhuta rasatmaka. I become the moon and supply the juice of life to all the vegetables. Now, Prabhupada always pointed out, how can you say the moon is a desert when its chief entity, Soma, is the one that makes vegetables succulent? So Prabhupada said the conclusion is, your so-called scientists and astronauts did not actually go to the moon. They went somewhere else. Here we see the Soma, the chief in charge of the moon, being personally concerned. What's happening with the trees? And he told the potatoes to stop. But he just didn't leave them with nothing, because they're Kshatriyas. You can't just tell a Kshatriya, control your senses and leave it at that. Narada tried that with Dhruva. And what did Dhruva tell him? I appreciate your advice about happiness and distress, fame and infamy, but I'm a Kshatriya. I'm not a Brahmin. I just can't be satisfied with that. I've got to get revenge against my father. So, here, the Prachetas, Soma's talking to them, telling them, stop being so angry, stop burning all the trees. But he just didn't leave them with that. He said, and by the way, I got a beautiful girl for you. That's the way you deal with Kshatriyas. They're not Brahmins. You just can't say, control your senses, be detached, No, he said, stop and take a look at this. And the description is there. The Prachetas all received from Lotcha's daughter, who had high, very beautiful hips, and married her according to the religious system. You may wonder, why are these descriptions in the Bhagavatam? High, very beautiful hips. There's descriptions of breasts also in the Bhagavatam. What's that there for? The whole point is to remind you that in the age of Kali, you don't know what real beauty is, even from the material point of view. You don't know what a beautiful person looks like in the age of Kali. Not only on earth, but you don't know about the beauty of the heavenly planets. So in this way, our cosmic view expands. We get to understand what's going on other planets. We get to understand the different standards of beauty. We get to see how all the entities, the living entities in the cosmos, are working together, how they're protected. All this information the Bhagavatam is giving you. So rather than think, oh, this is some kind of mythology, I don't understand it, better to try to see how you're getting information about things beyond the range of your senses. Any questions? We've covered a lot of ground today. Yes?
Can you ask a question that's not related to what you've just been speaking about?
Prefer a question about what we've been speaking about. Let's see if there's any of those.
All right.
Yeah.
You can see in our movement that, like you said, that we don't consult astrologers when we're thinking of getting married, or some of us don't, anyway.
Well, I didn't really say that. That was just, I was pointing out that some people use that as an excuse for a divorce.
Right, but you can see that there's many divorces and stuff within our movement, and kids are not being protected. So, do you think that we should actually consult astrologers and astrology first? Before we make an important decision?
That before marriage, that's the Vedic system. Otherwise, for other things, it's very difficult to find in the age of Kali astrologers powerful enough to give advice. But marriage is not such a subtle thing, you know. The astrologer simply looks for certain correspondences and gives his judgment. Does it add up to be very compatible, so-so, or not compatible? It's not like a subtle thing. It's very easy to see. Bhakti Vijayapurnamaraj Guru Goswami, he gives a very good explanation of astrology. And he explains that it's very difficult to find an astrologer who can deal with subtleties in the age of Kali, such as predicting world events, things like that. In Vedic times, yes, this could be done. Brahmanas would wander from house to house, and they could give you medical advice and astrological advice for free. They just want some milk or a little prasad to eat. But you don't have that now. Prabhupada points out the advantages of the Vedic system. You have these Brahmanas wandering everywhere. That means any person has access to knowledge for free. Just give the Brahmana a little something to eat. So, Prabhupada does mention in his purports that marriage means astrologers should be consulted. But the most important thing is, are the husband and wife Krishna conscious? Without that, what's the use?
But still, the husband and wife may be Krishna conscious, but it doesn't mean that they're, if they're within four walls, that they're actually compatible.
You are saying or asking?
Good advice.
Well, make it one or the other, please. It helps me out a bit, you know.
Well, I can see it.
Or is this social commentary?
Well, I study a little bit of astrology, so I'm not saying I'm an astrologer, but you can see that two people want to be Krishna conscious, and that's their aim, but still it doesn't mean, in my view, that they actually can be compatible within that ashram.
So what should they do if they find out that they aren't compatible? What should they do?
Well, that's a hard one.
No, they're already married and they found out they're not compatible. So what should they do?
Wait a little while.
And then?
38 more.
No, they're already married.
Oh, they're already married.
Yeah.
Too late.
Okay. Easy. Who is it? Shivananda. He's gone now. He was telling me how he and his wife were married. He didn't see his wife until she sat down at the marriage ceremony. But his parents had sorted it all out and consulted an astrologer. That's the normal way it's done. Prabhupada's point was always the main thing, they should be Krishna conscious. As a supplementary thing, you consult the astrologer. But the main thing is they have to be Krishna conscious. So I never said that, there's no question of considering material compatibility. Did you hear me say that?
No.
Okay. So. The main thing is they should be Krishna conscious. Marriage obviously is involving a certain amount of arrangement of matter, the male matter and the female matter. So there's no harm in getting some material consideration. But at the same time, we have to understand we are meant to be Krishna conscious. And even for the most compatible couples, from the astrological point of view, there's tough moments. And without Krishna consciousness, though, they won't make it. Any other questions?
Yes.
I was just going to ask, what about those that have actually not married and they've found out they're going to have a kid and it's still possible for them to come to Krishna consciousness?
For who to come?
Well, for a lady and a man who have not gotten married, but they've then, satisfied the senses and got pregnant. Is it still possible for them to... Obviously, they're not married, so it is a sin.
Well, they should become Krishna conscious, and for the sake of the child, they should try to marry. But what happens before you're Krishna conscious, a lot of times it's hard to sort out. It can be hard enough to sort out these things after you're Krishna conscious, but what you do before, sometimes we can't say. Sometimes they turn out to make a good marriage, or sometimes they have to go their separate ways, even in Krishna consciousness. So I'm trying to understand specifically what your question's about. Anyone can become Krishna conscious.
Yes.
So what is your question?
Well, just you were mentioning how important marriage is.
Yes.
To be, obviously.
Well, if for example, if it's you, if you can get the girl to marry you, and the authorities say yes, this will be helpful for both your Krishna consciousness, you should do it. But it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes the other person is not really interested in Krishna consciousness, or many times it's like that. Generally, if both are serious about Krishna consciousness, they marry in Krishna consciousness and straighten out the past. I know in my case, before I was a devotee, I was engaged to be married, and the girl wasn't interested in Krishna consciousness, and Srila Prabhupada chased her away. I couldn't figure out how to get out of it. I had all the excuses. Now, Krishna wouldn't want to hurt anybody, and if I leave her, she'll be hurt, and Krishna wouldn't want that. Finally, I just went before the deities, Radha Govinda in New York, and I prayed, Krishna, just get me out of this one, and I promise you never again. 2 weeks later, Prabhupada came to the temple, and he's giving a heavy lecture, and it's just too much for her, and she just left. I told this story before, I won't tell it again. You've heard it, right?
I probably haven't known.
I'll brief. I was just sitting in front of Prabhupada, right there. And he was just lecturing very powerfully, roaring like a lion. If you're optimistic about material life, you're an animal. And all of a sudden, I feel this tap on my shoulder, because I had left my fiancée of a month ago and I hadn't seen her, but I was always afraid if she comes to the temple, I'll be so weak, she'll drag me away. So, she was heavy Maya. Yeah. Of course, every man always thinks, yeah, my girlfriend was, she looked the best, she was a real knockout. So, she was a dancer, an actress, and a psychology graduate. All the Maya wrapped up in one. So, so you can understand my desperation. So I was in the temple as a new bhakta. I was always worried, if she comes, I'll be finished. Sounds funny now, I know, but anyway. So I would pray to the deities. And then 2 weeks later, Prabhupada came. And so I was sitting right in front of him. He was roaring like anything. The lecture is not on tape. I can't find it anywhere. It's not available by the tape ministry. He was just like just so powerful. If you're optimistic about material life, you're an animal. If you're a human being, you must be pessimistic. Then I feel this tap on my shoulder. And I look, and there she is. But I was so absorbed in Prabhupada's roaring, and he continued to roar, that I just looked right back at Prabhupada without acknowledging her presence. I didn't even blink an eye. And she practically burst out crying in the middle of the lecture. Like, what's going on here? Here's my man. I haven't seen him in a month, and he doesn't even blink an eye at me. What's happening here? And Prabhupada was roaring, if you're a human being, you must be pessimistic. So she just got up and split. She just left. And then Prabhupada, with a big smile on his face, said, but in Krishna consciousness, everything is optimistic. So after that, it's time for Artik. I was just jumping in front of the deities in ecstasy. I'm free! I'm free! I'm free! Anyway. Many times, though, the girl does, or the boy does agree to become Krishna conscious, and they work out. Turns out okay. Everything is different. Any other questions? Yes.
I just wanted to ask, do you think that a Gurukul upbringing of a child is just as important as a stable parental relationship?
Everything is important.
Which, if you had like one without the other, or which do you think would be more stable?
If you're going to force me into that kind of situation, without good parents who care and are willing to go through that austerity year after year, it's difficult. You can't just offload everything on the Gurukul system, you know? It doesn't work like that.
What about like a single parent thing?
Well, these are special cases. There's no such thing as a single parent in Vedic culture. Everybody's protected by somebody, but it's not like that these days. So, even with the best kind of Krishna conscious educational system, and by the way, we use that term Gurukula, but actually, we really have just day schools. Technically, Gurukula means the child is studying directly, physically, with the spiritual master. So, in any case, without Krishna conscious parents, even the best educational system is not enough. The parents have to take their responsibility. All right.
What if you've brought a child up reasonably favorably in Krishna consciousness, but they reach a point when they become teenagers, that then they're rebellious and they don't really hear about Krishna anymore? Should you push it, or should you, you know, just leave it, or it's a very difficult area?
You have to do the best you can. It's the child's life. You can lead a horse to the water, you can't make the horse drink, but you've got to do the best you can. Just like I give you an example of my mother. You know, she was just a Christian, but she went at it with full determination. Now she's gloating, oh, my sons, leading moral lives. I won in the end. She was willing to take some defeats for the ultimate victory, but she always had her mind on the ultimate victory, and she went through the austerity of, from her point of view, doing everything possible. She laid down the law in her house. You can't do this, you can't do that. She said, you guys, you make some girl pregnant, I'm not paying for it. She just laid down the law. So you knew if you wanted to do nonsense, you had to go somewhere else. That's the way it has to be. I do see a lack of that in parents today, even in our Krishna conscious parents. They don't know how to lay down the law in the house. They're afraid. We don't want to drive the kid away. We want to be sensitive. Even traditional materialist families knew how to lay down the law. It doesn't happen these days. But 20 years ago, it was quite common. The father would say, "Son, in my house, we will do it this way. If you don't like it, go get a job and get your own house. Finish." That's the way it was. I'm sure we have someone here whose parents were like that. Yeah. "In my house, we'll do it like this. You will follow such and such rules. You will be home at such and such a time. Otherwise, forget it." So my mother had her rules. "You all will go to church on Sunday. You will say your Bible verse before eating. You will do this. You will not do that. If you don't like it, then take care of yourself." But she wasn't cold-hearted in doing that. At the same time, she was giving all sorts of care and instruction.
So it should be like your main objective then is your family life. What if you're doing temple activities?
Your main objective is to be Krishna conscious. Otherwise, your family life is cats and dogs.
What if your devotional service is wearing you out? And so when you're at home, you're too tired to do what you're supposed to be doing.
It just takes some intelligent arrangement. It may not be devotional services wearing us out. It may be our material desires. Why are we playing devotional service?
So that could be like if you decide to be a workaholic or just, you know.
We just need to get some guidance how to arrange our life. Don't be so quick to blame it on devotional service. Just get some guidance how to arrange your affairs. Rather than say it's devotional service that's wearing me out, why not say I'm not yet able to arrange my life and I have failed to take guidance to do that? That's a better way of saying it. Never blame Krishna for anything, and blaming devotional service is blaming Krishna. Just like when I was a young Sankirtan devotee, we did Sankirtan in freezing weather in New York City wearing plastic shoes. Now, should I blame everyone back? "Oh, you sent us out with plastic shoes, freezing weather, 10 below zero. You didn't know about that letter from Prabhupada that in cold Western countries you could wear leather shoes. You didn't know about that letter he wrote to Germany. We were in New York, you didn't know about it. You exploited us. Therefore, I'm a mess today because of wearing plastic shoes 25 years ago. It's made me into a mean sannyasi who yells at innocent ladies." You get the whole thing, you know? All because of the authorities. There's no point in that. So instead, I just think we did the best we could under those circumstances. Now we know better. And we try to make that available to, you know, the devotees today. So just get some guidance. Don't fret. Accept someone who can give you good instruction how to arrange your household life. And do it. All right. All glories to the Prabhupada.